pour something flammable into your glass. It's Jaded Gamercast. My name is Lang. With me, as always, is Nathan. And we have two very special guests today, Nathan. You had a disclaimer before we introduce them. Just throw it out there.
In case at any moment this podcast starts to sound like a Justin Bieber concert, you will understand why when we announce our guests.
Very true, very true. And we're actually pouring something flammable into our mugs because this is a morning show. We're drinking at 10 a.m. But with us today, oh, cheers. There it is. With us today is Gemma Noon, who is the purveyor, the organizer of the Black Library Expo in Chestermere, Alberta, coming up October 6th and 7th. And with us on the show here today is Mr. Dan Abnett, one of our favorite writers. If you've listened to any of our podcasts in the past, you know that we've spent hours going on talking about the books that he has written.
I was
going
to say, we've had entire
spoiler episodes about the books.
Where we can just geek out about the books.
Dan, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, guys.
That's excellent. So, Gemma, talk to us a little bit about the expo, what's going to be happening, what the ticket prices are. Just give us the rundown for anybody who's interested in going to this here in Alberta.
Yep, sure. Black Library are coming to Chestermere, Alberta, which is just outside of tiny town, just outside of Calgary. Basically, it's kind of like Black Library Live in the UK, which it means we've got 8 authors there to do signings, do seminars, basically give you the opportunity to meet these guys and have a chat with them. It's going to be pretty laid back, so you will have opportunities to talk with the guys. It's not like we're going to just put you through a mail to get your book signed and then tell you to leave. There'll be a gaming tournament on that. It's the lovely Nathan.
Dan Abnett, fuck off.
lovely
Did you bring Greg back? No.
See, I've been really good trying to not mention Bragg, and you just ruined it already.
No, you said to me that you wouldn't bring it up again, and I felt that was, I was challenge accepted. That's how I felt about that one in particular.
Oh, fine. I'm sorry. I will we'll grill Dan later, as always. I think it'd be the fifth time I've had this conversation with him, but okay. Nathan, the lovely Nathan, is helping to organize the gaming tournament that'll be going on at the expo as well. There is a bar on premises too, guys, so I'm sure I'll know where to find you. Mm-hmm. It's going to be pretty awesome, basically. The tickets are $20. That includes all the seminars, it includes all the sign-ins, and if you're fast enough to get a place on the tournament, it does include the tournament as well.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so obviously Nathan and I are going to be going to this. We've got a bunch of other people who are going to be coming with us, but obviously for events like this to thrive here in this community, people have to be involved. And really, you know, we've got a really strong gaming community here, a very tight gaming community. And within that gaming community, it's very easy for us to sell this thing out if everybody is coming out to this. If you want these authors and these events to happen more often in Alberta, you have to support it. The Emperor expects, right, Dan?
I would say so, yeah. I think considering that the was it 9 of us are coming all the way from Feffing, England to Alberta to do this, then I think the least you can Feffing well do is show up and say hello to us, basically.
All right, that just made
it. I didn't swear there, Jim.
No, not at all.
Wonderful. Okay, so obviously if you guys have any other questions, what's the website, Gemma?
www.chestermereexpo.ca. We're on Facebook as well. As
you can find
Facebook
them on Facebook as well, through the Jaded Gamercast Facebook page as well. I believe both Nathan and I have liked the page, so if you go through to our likes, you can get there as well. If you have any other questions, feel free to post them on the Facebook group, but let's get into the interview here. So Dan, this is going to be your first time in Canada, correct?
No, I've done it many times in Canada.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Oh, I see what you mean. Yes. I've been to Games Day in Toronto a couple of times, but Canada is a country I've not been to as much as I'd like to, so I'm really looking forward to this.
Wonderful. All right, so let's get into the first question here that I have for you, Dan. Hopefully we'll spark a little bit of conversation with this. What were your expectations when you first started writing books for a niche tabletop science fiction war game? I know that you had said on other interviews that Black Library had approached you as a writer and they wanted you to write some books, but what were your expectations? Did you really know that you would be 13 books deep in a Gaunt's Ghost series and what a lot of people consider to be kind of the fuel behind what brought Black Library up to where it is now?
Well, I didn't have any kind of expectations at that kind of level of success. I mean, let's put it into perspective. I don't know how many languages Black Library now publishes in, but it's a fuck of a lot. And I've sold 2 gazillion million. I can't remember how many it is alone.
Well, I think a percentage of that comes between Nathan and I because. Yeah, you purchased the books, the e-books.
Yeah, I was going to say, I do have 2 copies of every of your books.
Yeah, one for reading, one for signing. You have to have 2.
There you go.
One one for sleeping with quietly. Yeah.
Don't tell my wife.
Keep it under the pillow. Keep it secret.
There's, safe. I've had, let me think, 5 New York Times bestsellers. I don't know how many the cadre of authors there have had, but each Horus Heresy book hits the New York Times bestseller. It's quite extraordinary. And Black Library have gone from not existing at all in 1995 when Mark Gascoigne set it up to being the fifth largest science fiction publisher in the world now. Right. I think that's extraordinary.
Well, it's pretty impressive, but I remember back when I was working for Games Workshop when these books were just starting to kind of catch steam. I think this was right around Necropolis being released, and we had them on the shelves and people started reading them, and then they would spread that word and people would start reading them, and then we just couldn't keep the stuff on the shelves in the stores there. Then when they started going to sell in chapters and they started going to sell, in the bigger retail bookstores, it was really kind of amazing to see how quickly that stuff had taken off. Even people who weren't involved in the games, were very excited to read these stories, even just kind of for the historically based, like that same feeling, kind of Band of Brothers feeling that you get out of the Gaunt's Ghost books.
I think so. I think, the thing is, I'd been writing freelance for about 10, 12 years when they came to me, and I'd basically written comics. I mean, comics is the thing that I still do, and it's the thing I'm still pretty well known for.
Love them.
And I wanted to write novels. I'd written several novels of my own that I'd never published. I wanted to write long-form fiction, and Games Workshop came to me in the mid-90s and said, "You write comics, come and write comics for us, we're going to publish." And I went, "Yeah, great." And luckily, I had a background going back to the early 80s as a kid, basically playing role playing games, so Traveller, Call of Cthulhu, Dungeons and Dragons, RuneQuest, that kind of thing. So I was aware of Games Workshop, I was aware of White Dwarf, and although I had not played much 40K or Warhammer, I understood intuitively that kind of English sensibility about the way it works, that British sort of dark, slightly twisted thing that makes it so attractive, I think.
With lots of skulls. So,
yeah, we were talking about the skull fetish earlier that Games Workshop has. Tower of skulls, moored with skulls, with a skull hot tub.
It's just Britishness.
It's Britishness. There is nothing that cannot be improved with the addition of more skulls.
Oh, I beg to differ here. Here in Canada, we find it a little odd. Or as Gemma would say, pants. Which medium do you really enjoy most? Like, which one do you feel is the most creatively open for you? Do you feel like comic books are? Or you feel like novels with kind of your own?
No, novels, definitely. They hired me on as a comic book writer, then they asked me to write short stories for them, and then they asked me to write novels because they could see that I got the gist of the universe, and that was a great opportunity. So my expectation, your original question, my expectation was, hey, someone's going to pay me money to write novels. I wanted to do that, and I hoped people would like them. And after the first three or four, I realized that I was getting this. I mean, again, as a comic book writer, you never think about writing franchise fiction, because that's essentially what you do. Everybody wants to write the X-Men, and people have written the X-Men before. Everyone wants to write the Hulk, the Hulk or whatever. So there is a sort of, within publishing, there is a kind of snobbery about whether you write original fiction, i.e. your own things, or whether you write tie-in. And I never blanched at writing tie-in, and I just wrote the best novels I could within that framework, and people would come and say to me the greatest compliments, things like, "That's much better than I thought it was going to be."
Well, it wasn't shit. Thank you, Dan.
The increased success. I love the fact that it's been successful. I love the fact that it's gone beyond the framework of the game. It's gone beyond the framework of the hobby itself, so that people will read the books and they have no contact at all with the game at all, even though it might then bring them back into the Games Workshop's fold. But these books are, not just by me, but by all the other authors, these are fiction in their own right. Sarah Pimber, tweeted me a picture of somebody reading my novels on the tube the other day. You know, that's just like, that's the London Underground. But, it's just like this wonderful, wonderful sense of
We're not American. We're aware of most of the I don't even know what the name for it is. The lingo. Let's just throw lingo. Did you ever think of putting that on like the inside cover? A quote from random fan, not as bad as I thought it would be.
It is the way that it's sort of escaped from its origins, I think. I mean, one of the other things, and it's probably worth mentioning this, is that when they first hired me on, I started to go to games days in the UK, which were, even there back then were like 7,000 or 8,000 people. But they would tend to be all boys. They were all teenage boys. And you go along the first couple of years, that's the way it works.
That hasn't changed much. I think it's Nathan's wife and Gemma.
Because after 4 years of publishing the novels, we discovered that suddenly there were girls coming to the games days. Now, obviously not in such numbers that it changed the balance, but the demographic had changed. And one of the reasons is that the sisters and girlfriends of the boys that were going along anyway didn't really want to play the game and possibly didn't want to just paint the figures because they were, you know, and they do, many of them do. But the point is they were actually interested in the universe, and the fiction suddenly gave them an access point to the universe that they were interested in as opposed to playing the game. And suddenly the queue was sort of almost 50-50 gender split. And that made Games Workshop surprised. And that delighted us because we actually did see a change. We were essentially inducting people in to the universe who wouldn't otherwise want to be there. Yeah, and so it's those kind of changes that, you know, success be damned. Well, not really. I'm enjoying it.
I was like, well, reel that back a little bit there, buddy. What was that, Gemma?
I said that's basically how I got into it. I was actually reading the Gaunt's Ghosts books and the Gotrick and Felix books. My then boyfriend was spending copious amounts of money on small plastic figures, and I'm looking at it thinking, really? And so he gave me the books to read, and then I ended up a bigger fan than he was.
There you are.
That's I could also paint better than him, and that's kind of why the relationship ended.
I think most do paint better.
Yeah.
Naturally, they've been practicing on their nails since they were 13. So you were talking about, like, you enjoy the idea of writing novels a little bit more and kind of the original characters and things like that. You started writing Hypernaturals for Boom, which, from what I've seen there on the credits, is something that you've created with Andy Lanning and I can't remember who the other person was. Feel like that's opening up a new medium for you, being able to create your own original characters in a comic book format?
It is, yeah. I mean, there is a great satisfaction in comics writing, you know, really long-standing. I mean, Andy and I write together because it's fun. And being a freelancer, this can be very, very solitary.
Right.
So we started writing together because it was a collaborative process. So a lot of the stuff we do for America is, you know, when we do together. When we're not working together, I'm writing novels and I'm writing for 2000 AD in the UK and I'm writing other things. Andy's inking. So it's just, you know, we're just doing a long run now on the New Mutants. Before that, there was things like Guardians of the Galaxy and Legion of Superheroes. And all of these things are great fun because you take something that's been around for a long time and you find a new way of doing it. Now we're getting the opportunity both together and indeed for my own part to create stuff where people go, we want you to invent something. So Hypernaturals, Cosmic Superheroes is what we do really, really well, but we've invented it and the universe that the stories happen in. So these are stories that would never, although it's very similar to like Guardians of the Galaxy or Legion of Superheroes, DC and Marvel, these are stories that we couldn't tell there because the universe, the continuity of the universe wouldn't stand it. We built our own universe. Similarly, over at Vertigo, I've got my own creator and series there called The New Dead Guardians. First time I've written for Vertigo. And that's kind of, basically it's Downton Abbey meets The Walking Dead.
It's very good.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I pick up any comic book that has your name on it, to be perfectly honest with you. You know, I really enjoyed the run that you did for New Mutants. I thought in particular the one issue of New Mutants with Magma going on the date with Lucifer was particularly charming and entertaining. That was one of the best comics I've read in a long time, and I wanted to throw that out at you. But yeah, Nathan and I both read Hypernaturals. I'm looking forward to more there. It's pronounced Quantinuum.
Quantinuum, yes.
Okay, good. There was the double U's threw me off. I didn't know if it was a British thing or if I just didn't know how to read.
No,
probably that other one.
I have been drinking.
Yeah.
Cheers to that. Okay, so let's move on a little bit more here. How much longer do you see yourself writing Gaunt's Ghost novels?
Well, that's a loaded question. I never expected to write 13 of them. As you are aware, that After the first few were written, we decided to subdivide them into blocks so that each omnibus represents a different story arc. Mm-hmm. And we're now on the, I'm going to say fourth story arc. I'm pretty sure. Yes, it is the fourth story arc, which is four novels. So there's two more to go in this arc. And that isn't the end. There's going to be at least a couple more after that, which will form possibly the final.
That's awesome.
The thing is, the series grows as I write it. Mm-hmm. I have particular goals in mind as I'm going along, thinking, well, I've got to do this with this storyline. That's another novel. There's this here, there's this there. And any, you know, when I wrote the first couple, I could see a book or two ahead. When I got to six or seven novels, I could see probably three or four books ahead because there was that much material had been generated. Now we've got to this stage with Blood Pact and the latest one, Salvation's Reach, where these are such huge ensemble things. They're driven by all the characters in it. And I know, because I know you're going to ask me about it, I have a propensity for killing people. So my
that was Nathan's question.
It's reducing all the time. But even so, just the number of people there, they have their own storylines that I'd like to explore. Yeah. So there are major things to do. So I know what the next two books are going to happen. And my God, it's going to shock you so much. When you read the next one, which will be out next year, when you read the next one, there is so much in Salvation's Reach, which we will realize that I was telling you shit that you didn't realize at the time.
You hear that, morons? Dan Abnett was telling you shit.
Yeah, seriously, it's all there. You'll go, oh my God, he actually said that, and I didn't realize what he was saying, because that's the where it's going to go later on. So there is a huge amount of, it's not hidden, it's just, I don't know.
Well, it was like that in Ravenor as well, where they, in the first Ravenor book, they come across like the stripped skeleton, and they just, you kind of don't know what's going on until later in the book, so you realize it was the robo-pigeons.
Yeah.
I used to play bass for robo-pigeons. Honestly, I was going to throw this at you as well, from as a massive fan. When Kafran bit it, I cried in bed with my wife. We were sitting there reading. I get to the end of the book, and I was just like, oh, and I start tearing up, and she looks over at me, because she's not a nerd, so she's just exceptionally embarrassed at the fact that this is happening. And she's like, what is wrong with you? And I was just like, it's fine, it's not a big deal. It's just, it's not a big deal. And like, really, I appreciate so much the idea of, you know, being able to get this invested in the characters, and the idea where you say to me, oh, you just wait till this next one, you dumb fucker. Yeah. Just wait till this happens and you're going to get blown away.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't help but look forward to that, because anytime I try to explain the books to people, and you end up in this situation where you start trying to explain Necropolis or First and Only, and you start thinking to yourself, like, wow, that was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that sense of like history and time having passed, which I find is missing in a lot of books that I read, where they say, oh, and 100 years passed. And you're just like, yeah, it feels like the same book. Like, what happened in that 100 years?
I am a huge fan of soap operas, funnily enough. I love soap operas. And the thing I love about soap operas is the longevity.
British soap operas? Coronation Street, I was going to say.
Coronation Street, The Archers, that kind of thing on the radio over here. I love those things. I mean, what I'm saying is, in some respects, I see Gaunt's Ghost as a kind of soap opera, because you're moving along through the lives of these people. And sometimes the resonance of what happens to them is much more significant because you know all the other things that have happened. It's not just an interesting guy and then this happens to him. There's a great moment you mentioned, to me, writing it, I mean, I hope it affects you because it affects me when I write it. That's the reason I do it.
Did you cry when Kaf died?
No, actually, I'll tell you about that in a second. First of all, the perennial question is, why did you kill Bragg? Everyone wants to ask me that, because that was the first one it happened. And they actually ask it to me in that voice. Doesn't matter where they come from. They could be American.
Oh, I know.
That one's for you,
Jim. I was just talking to some JA over here who was complaining about Bragg dying. See, I liked Crew better than Bragg, so I was like,
No. It's not bothered me. It's the fact that you dragged Koo out for like another two books.
I know.
He was convinced he was going to get Larkin, and
That's what made it so good. Is I loved him to death, and like I've created, and I mean this is literally the nerdiest compliment I think you can possibly get. I have created role play characters in like the Star Wars universe off of like WEG games based off of Koo, because I'm just like, this character is fucking amazing. Like he says sure is sure all the time, and he's got a Cockney accent. We just don't stop.
I was going to say, you know now that you owe Dan royalties, and he's going to collect.
I'm not playing him anymore.
As well, so, you know, you're stuffed. I think let me tell you about Koo, first of all. I've told this story before, but it's probably worth retelling if you don't know it. Koo first appears in Honor Guard, doesn't it? Yes, he does. And Honor Guard, the fourth Gaunt book, was a moving experience for me to write, because I'd written 75,000 words of it and my computer died and etched the entire manuscript.
Oh.
Destroyed it.
Oh.
I had a month I had a month deadline left, and it was early days, and there was no sort of flexibility or wiggle room. So basically, my boss said, yeah, you've got to rewrite it as fast as you possibly can. So I, honor guard, I wrote in the version you've got that is published was rewritten basically from notes and memory. Because and by the way, that was the day I learned to back up properly. But
hard lesson.
The version of Honor Guard that's published is the one that I rewrote from notes and memory in a month. But here's the really interesting thing. It's much, much better than the one I lost, which I was perfectly happy with and would have been perfectly publishable. But for some reason, I was writing so fast. It was like I'd rehearsed it. And then it was just all coming out. I wasn't even thinking about what was happening. And I wrote the whole novel. And it's much, much better. It's got all sorts of internal symmetries and patterns and stuff there that I wasn't even aware that I was doing. But one of the things that happened writing it the second time around is Ku appeared. Ku wasn't in the first version. Ku wasn't a character that I planned. Ku just happened. I was writing one day feverishly trying to get this thing done. And I suddenly realized I was writing a scene that I'd written before. And I was trying to remember how it worked. And suddenly there was this new character in there. I was going, fuck off, what are you doing? I haven't got time with you. I don't know what you're here for. And he refused to leave the story. You know, I kept trying to write him out and he wouldn't leave the story. Oh, and to such an extent that not only did he spontaneously appear in the manuscript and I was too busy to edit him out, he then determined the course of the story for the next four novels. So and I just thought, that's a really, really spooky thing.
Computers.
So there you go. And you also mentioned Catherine just now, and I think that's worth mentioning as well, is that quite often I know that a book needs a death in it. I know sometimes I know that a book doesn't need a death in it, but usually it's planned and I usually know who it's going to be. Every now and then it takes me by surprise. But the one about Catherine is I wrote the, and that's what, that's The Armour of Contempt, isn't it? Yeah, The Armour of Contempt. Yeah. When I was writing that book, I knew that the book would only work if there was a really tragic death of a beloved character at the end. But it wasn't going to be Catherine. It was going to be a completely different character. And about three pages before it happened, and I'd set it up all the way through the book, about three pages before it happened, I just sat down and went, do you know what? I've picked the wrong person. It'd be much more impactful if it was Catherine. And then he got the chop at a short notice without me planning it. I'd planned a death, but not his. And I think
it was impactful.
It's so unexpected because it was unexpected.
Yeah. That's awesome. So Nathan actually came up with a good question regarding Amazon.
Yeah, I do follow you on Facebook, and so I noticed that you were a little perturbed when Amazon let the cat out of the bag for your new Eisenhorn Ravener book. And I was just wondering, like, does this happen often? And what did you feel when you woke up that morning to see that all of the planning that Black Library might have had on how to market this was basically thrown out the window?
Well, and I'll preempt it right here so that you don't actually have to say anything bad. Fuck Amazon and their fucking assholes, because you've got PR things to worry about. I don't have PR things to worry about. So you can just nod your head quietly. It's a podcast. You'll see it.
There's slightly more to it than that because I think my perturbation about that wasn't they announced it because in order to get these books out there, in order that the mechanisms like Amazon actually are extraordinarily valuable and they will you know, alert people to the arrival of a book, and that information did only appear on Amazon because Black Library had given that information to them. The thing that was that alarmed me was that they published an image of the of the cover,
yeah.
And all I'd ever seen was a rough version of the cover. I hadn't seen the finished cover, so it was the cover artwork and everything like that. And I was going, oh my god, I didn't know my book would look like that, which was much, much more concerning. And that was just a simple case of they'd run the designs past me. I'd have gone yeah, and they hadn't actually got around to showing me the color one. So it was more to do with that. I think any time Amazon or any similar thing like that, it could even be a website, it could be Facebook, it could be anything, pre-announces something you're trying to keep as a secret, it's always disappointing, but it's still great publicity. And I just think the fact that I went, oh fuck, they put the cover up there, was great publicity. So I really went, oh, I better have a look at that now. You know, and I didn't do it deliberately like that. It's just, you know, we live in a, I mean, that's one of the reasons the Black Library has grown so much, is that we really, really appreciate the fact that there is this vast sort of social networking and fan networking out there and commercial networking and things like Amazon that allows people to know these things are around, you know, and they're going to be coming up. It wasn't a complaint. It wasn't, and the cover looks great, by the way. So I was very happy.
I mean, you've already got a couple pre-orders between the three of us nerds here. That's to say the least.
Well, see, I'm actually going to treat it the same way I did with Salvation's Reach, because when it went up on the Black Library page, I ended up sending them an email, and I was just like, so how do you do your shipping? Do you do it like Games Workshop, where you wait till the release date and ship it the Monday after? Or do you ship it in advance? They're like, oh, we just send it out, you know, exactly 3 weeks before, regardless of your shipping. I'm like, so if I buy express shipping, I can have it 3 weeks early? And they were like, yes. So I paid for shipping that cost three times as much as the book, and I don't regret a thing.
No, exactly. Because like, you got like, it before the spoilers hit.
Yeah, I'm just like,
spoilers hit the internet.
I had it
read
before release date because of Black Library, so I'm just going to do the same with that one.
Yeah, well, Dan, to give you a little bit of background here, Nathan and I are both ex Games Workshop employees, so we obviously have our viewpoints on Games Workshop and their shipping policies and things of that nature. But no, I agree. Amazon is an amazing tool just for getting us nerds our fixes when it comes to stuff like that.
Yes, okay. We should never underestimate the power of the Black Library's own website. I mean, I think it would be a very, very obscure thing that you can't get via Black Library themselves. I mean, they keep a print-on-demand catalog for all books that are slightly more obscure or not necessarily in print at the moment. And they've got brilliant e-books that you can download instantly, mm-hmm. and they patch them up brilliantly as well. So you know, if Amazon is your gateway to the new stuff, Amazon is also a gateway to the Black Library itself. And I think, you know, sort of whenever people say, how do you get hold of your books? Go to the Black Library. It's easy to find. I mean, it's so simple. And once you've got that, if you're then having trouble, then start looking at the more obvious suppliers like Amazon.
Can I do a shameless expo plug here?
Yeah.
We're getting pre-release titles. I don't know what they are yet, but I do know roughly when Pariah's due out.
Well, I think we already had a couple people on Facebook tell you to pre-order a few. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, the limited edition stuff usually that you're getting from Black Library is probably worth the time spent to do it. So even if you're getting your ticket to get your hands on that stuff, get it signed by Dan Abnett and the other authors.
Figuring if you're willing to pay three times the book's face cover value to get it shipped, you might as well buy a ticket and come pick it up in person and get it signed while you're there, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a good lesson to take home. Okay, so I have this theory, and I'm going to get nerdy on you again here.
Oh, are you really going?
I'm going to go with a theory.
When you stop being nerdy,
it's my bread and butter, even though I don't get paid for doing this. But really, I mean, I'm going to get nerdy on you here a little bit. I've had this theory with regards to Gaunt's Ghosts over the last few books. It wasn't so prevalent in the last one, and I wanted to know if there's any solid base to what I'm thinking here, if I'm just completely off the wall.
I was going to say, you know he's not going to admit to anything, even if you're not.
He doesn't have to. I'll take silence as an answer, to be perfectly honest with you at this point. But okay, after Jerun, or Jeron, we were not 100% sure.
Jerion.
You suddenly thought that there was an I in there, Nathan?
No, I just know how to pronounce an E.
What's that?
There's an E in it. So I pronounce it Gerion, but that's just me.
Gerion.
The correct way of pronouncing all these words is the way you do it. Every reader should have ownership of their own pronunciation. So there you go.
Oh, I know. I read a book and I see a character's name, and if I read it wrong the first time without thinking, I'll never change that in my brain. Like, I think it took me four books to actually start pronouncing it Tana Creed and not Crid.
Yes, I did the same thing. It wasn't until she does the thing where it's like, Creed, what? Like, the thing, no, with eyes instead, and you're like, ah-ha-ha!
Thank you, Dan Abbott. But really, it seems to me that anyone who was on that Jerun mission... And I'm going to say Jerion mission. It seems like they've come back with like this weird sort of psychic ability. Every one of them have displayed some sort of, you know, hypernatural sort of ability. You know, Larkin's shooting people in the dark. Gaunt's able to see things that before they happen. You know, the comms guy is hearing things over. You know, like every single one of them, maybe except for Ron. Even though he kind of did when he knew that stuff
Ron's
was coming up from
Ron's
the sewers.
Just a badass.
He is a badass. But really, it seems like they all have a little bit of extra ability. They're not just the guardsmen they used to be. Is there any sort of weight to that? All right. Done and done. I've made my day. Okay, we'll get on to another question here. Will you or Andy Lanning be
I'll answer your question before you get there. I'll answer your question with another thing that you need to think about, is that there are all sorts of things going on in the series. So whether there is any validity to your theory or not, there are all sorts of other things happening in the series which, like I said, are there in plain sight, but you may not realize the significance of them. And a lot of the stories, when you've written 13 novels, sometimes you make one makes mistakes and forgets little points of continuity. And when you notice them, you go back and try and correct them. And most of them are seamless little bits of invisible mending. But every now and then you realize that there's a continuity mistake so huge that you either confess to it or you make it pretend that it's deliberate. And there is something that's coming. There's something coming in the next couple of books that is in response to that. There is a continuity error, which is no longer a continuity error because it's now a plot point, and no one really seems to have noticed it yet.
I've heard this story. I've heard this because this was from Necropolis.
Around about that point, yeah.
Okay, Necropolis, Honor Guard, Ghostmaker. Apparently, there was some I was not able to find it, and I looked online. Okay. So, because he had mentioned
it
in another podcast.
Well, it's not on
podcast.
The internet. It doesn't exist.
Well, I mean, fair enough. Fair enough.
That's the fact.
Where's the drink? I need to top up. Okay. Well, thank you very much for that, Dan, because that did kind of make my day, at least make me feel like less of a psychotic theory nerd. Because I've been catching shit from Nathan for that theory for a while now, where he's like, that's bullshit. That's not happening. And I'll take your silence as validity, because that makes me feel good about myself. Are you and Andy Lanning going to be involved in the Guardians of the Galaxy movie at all?
Well, clearly the Guardians of the Galaxy movie is based on our run. I mean, that's it. The Guardians of the Galaxy prior to us writing it were different characters.
Awful. I'm sorry.
And the Guardians of the Galaxy, all the characters that are in it were put together and we're incredibly flattered to see that the Marvel takes it that seriously. They want to do that with it. Of course, movie making is completely different from comics. I know that Ed Brubaker was astonished to discover the new Captain America movie is essentially Winter Soldier. I mean, nobody told him. Nobody told Jim Starlin that Thanos is in the Avengers movie. You know, so you know, we Andy and I were standing in front of the screen at the San Diego Comic Convention as much as everybody else, going, "Oh, cool, a Guardians of the Galaxy movie. That's great." You know, and that's no slur on Marvel. It's just that's not the way it works. They don't necessarily. At some point, they might give us a phone call and go, you know, thanks for that, guys, because look what we did with it. But it's, you know, it's work for hire material, and that's the way it works. I hope they I hope they make something of the minor supporting characters that we put into our running Guns of the Galaxy, because those are the ones we actually get creator acknowledgement on.
Like
so let's hope Cosmos in it.
Yes, instance, please, you know. Cosmos. I would be exceptionally happy to see Cosmos. But no, I read the whole series. I absolutely adored it. I really felt like when they announced that they were going to make that into a movie, it's funny because you look at Marvel, and Marvel's so driven, much like Games Workshop, very driven by the profit margins and kind of what's selling. I mean, that's why we've got 4 Deadpool comics and 8 Wolverines with fucking low writing.
Like Dogpool even for pizza?
Why not? Yeah. Sure. I mean, they literally, like, they milk that sales, you know, hike for anything that it's worth. And Guardians of the Galaxy, from what I knew in the comic stores that I went to, you know, always sold very well. People were very excited about it. It was actually one of the easier comics for me to get people who didn't read comics kind of into it, because it was easier to say you don't have to read 300 back issues to have this foundation of understanding the characters' motivations. You've got these new characters who existed in Marvel before this comic was being written, but are kind of, you know, net new. They're fresh. So you can pick it up from here and just enjoy it from the front. You know, front to back all the way through. And that's always what I kind of appreciated about Guardians of the Galaxy. So it's interesting. Were the sales high enough that they suddenly said, we're going to do this instead of a Doctor Strange movie or a Nick Fury movie?
I think it presented a different realm of storytelling they could play with. I think that they've seen how successful the Avengers has been, and that, you know, those mainstream characters like that have gone, let's go cosmic. It's really interesting. I mean, we got a good readership on that book, and we got a huge amount of critical acclaim, which is fantastic. But at the time, nobody at Marvel, bless them, got cosmic. They couldn't understand why
the extra galactic stuff.
Yeah, they just as far as they're concerned, they didn't get it. Again, I think it's a particularly British thing that Andy and I quite liked the idea of putting superheroes in space, so we did it. And you know, that's why Jack Flagg through most of the run of Guardians keeps going, I hate cosmic stuff. I don't get cosmic stuff, because he's meant to be the token voice of Marvel. He's Joe Quesada. That's what he is. He's just going, I don't understand why people. I don't understand what's going on, but I mean that in a you know, it's sort of an appreciative way, because they were sort of really surprised at the way it worked, and they liked us to stick into our guns. And one of the reasons I think our stories were quite effective is because Marvel didn't care about these characters. They were D-list characters. There we could go. Do anything we liked with them. And that's one of the other things that Guardians represents compared to the Avengers.
Like having Groot say nothing but I am Groot.
Exactly, yeah. But with the Avengers as a franchise, you've got and the same can be applied to Spider-Man or the X-Men. These are absolute tentpole characters in the Marvel Universe that you actually, there's surprisingly few things you can do with them because they've always got to be put back in the toy box the way you found them. Mm-hmm. So you can do the classic storylines. But there is a sense that any savvy fan who's read, say, Thor or Captain America all these years will never be surprised. All they'll be is delighted to see that storyline brought into being on the screen. With Guardians of the Galaxy in the comic, by implication in the film as well, you can do anything because these are not characters that have got that kind of sense of legacy that you can't mess around with. And I think that's one of the things. I mean, some of our storylines and twists and stuff in the comic were so surprising because nobody minded if we broke the toys. And that's what made it a compelling read, I think. It gave us the same sort of creative freedom with that book that I've got over Gaunt's Ghost, where I can do really shocking things to characters and really do dramatic things in a storyline that people will go, I had no idea that was happening, but I didn't see it coming, but it had a huge emotional impact because I believe it has happened. It's lovely to write, Iron Man or Spider-Man or something like that, or Batman over at DC. But the point is, you know that eventually you've got to reset it so that it's going to be Batman and, you know, and somebody else can take over.
I think some sort of orphan that he can put in danger.
Yes.
I'm more of an Iron Man fan, as people well know.
He has an Iron Man tattoo.
I have an arc reactor tattooed on my chest.
Excellent.
Yeah, we're tattooed up. We're a bunch of nerds that way. But I do actually have an arc reactor tattooed on my chest. Oh, did you get the Green Lantern? Oh, the Yellow Lantern.
Sinestro and Blue.
Oh, that's awesome. I like that. That's the first time I've seen those.
Last weekend.
I think that's really interesting because I was talking with Gemma earlier in the week, kind of going back and forth saying, you know, have you read any of Dan's comics? You know, him and Andy, you know, they've done some really great work. Like Guardians of the Galaxy is the one that I've always kind of recommended to people if they're wanting to get into comics. So like Gemma, I would throw that back to you and say, if you start with Guardians of the Galaxy, that works you into the Annihilation series, and then that works you into the War of Kings series, and you can read a lot more, and it kind of branches out really well. I actually really loved what you did with the Shi'ar stuff, because I was always a huge fan of the Imperial Guard for the Shi'ar, and nobody ever gave them so much as a one-liner until you actually started creating depth in these characters, and I appreciated it immensely.
Fantastic, thank you.
Okay, so with the Guardians of the Galaxy making its way to the big screen, what do you feel is the largest hurdle for the Warhammer 40,000 universe being delivered to a mainstream audience? Because, you know, for the longest time, we've pushed for it. I mean, the nerds who play this game, we want nothing more than a Gaunt's Ghost movie or a Space Marines movie or something that really reflects our love. I would take Gaunt's Ghost over anything. I mean, we did this whole conversation about which actor would be the best actor for Gaunt. Hours of nerddom happening here. What do you feel is the biggest hurdle?
Who's your pick? Best.
Oh, it changes on a monthly basis. Actually, it's regularly. I mean, I cast all the characters in all the series, but Gaunt's Ghost particularly in my head, just so I could keep tabs on them in terms of characters. In fact, since day one of the series, Val has always been Kevin Bacon for some reason.
Oh,
and when I was in San Diego this year, I got into a lift and Kevin Bacon got in the lift with me. And I really wanted to tell him that I'm basing a character on him for the last 15 years. And I could, you know, turbo express elevators are really fast, and you don't get that. You sound like a geek when you start saying that to Kevin Bacon in an elevator. So I kind of bailed on that. But anyway.
Okay, you know what? That's amazing, because now anytime I read your books, I will now picture Varl as Kevin Bacon. I don't think there's any way around that. And I love Kevin Bacon. He was amazing in X-Men First Class. I thought he was fantastic.
Absolutely. Although it's Footloose era Kevin Bacon.
Well, obviously he's not that. Yeah, he's not that old.
No, I'm kidding.
But what do you feel is the biggest hurdle for movies? You know, essentially taking the 40K universe into the mainstream, like big silver screen summer blockbuster type stuff.
It would be fantastic, and I absolutely understand why everybody wants to do it. And I was involved in the Ultramarines attempt where I think we made a pretty brave stab at giving you some moving picture version of the universe.
Yeah.
I think what people tend to underestimate really is the idea that Warhammer 40,000 and Warhammer, and indeed all the games, the core of the Games Workshop, is at its very best, a great hobby. It's this vast thing that doesn't just exist in popularity for a few months, but exists through people's lives, and there's got to be the continuity to keep building on. It's that longevity and that soap opera-ness that we were talking about earlier on. And I think the real danger is if somebody made a great big budget film of games of Warhammer 40,000, and it was huge, and suddenly everybody wanted a piece of 40K, which would be great for a few years, and then it would sort of die away. When you're someone like Marvel, for instance, they can make a big film of the Avengers. Suddenly, the Avengers is hot for 5 or 6 years, and then when that begins to die away, then maybe that's when Guardians of the Galaxy becomes hot, and they've got different properties they can roll to the forward each time one of them begins to run out of steam. So the X-Men can take over from Spider-Man, as the, you know, you see what I mean. The same with DC and this kind of stuff. With Warhammer 40K, it's a universe. It is this one totality universe. Even if you make specific films about Gaunt's Ghosts or Space Marines, you're buying into an alternative place that you can go and take your imagination. And the really horrible thing to happen is if they made a film, it made a huge amount of impact and then took away because it just became... mainstream again. And at that point, that would, I think, do some critically bad things to the Warhammer universe that we all engage with on a regular basis, because it would suddenly make it not quite as vibrant as it is. And I think that's the biggest stumbling block, is that we really want to see it happen and we really want it to be a huge success, but that's in that success might be a real downturn in what we actually really like. So I think we should be cautious about it.
Well, Gemma, you've read the books. You don't really play the game as much. You haven't really been into the comics
but I'm terrible. That's why I don't play. I am appalling.
I was going to say, that's no excuse. I know guys that lose every game with a smile on their face.
And that's how it
goes.
Do
they lose every game to 11-year-olds, and it's like the 11-year-old's third or fourth game?
All right, fair enough. You're shit.
Thank you. I was going to say, we
try to play in bars and adult establishments so the 11-year-olds can't come in.
No, exactly. We don't want to beat up 11-year-olds. But what do you think is the hurdle there? Because, I mean, you know, you're obviously involved in the literature side of it pretty big, and... like, do you agree with Dan? Like, the biggest hurdle is losing that control over the universe for the sake of monetary gain and mainstream, and, you know, we have to appeal to all audiences? Or do you feel like it's something that you could adapt for a couple films?
From my perspective, coming just from the books, for example, because obviously we stuck a lot of science fiction and I've been in libraries for years. The first big hurdle we have to get past, obviously, is that it's franchise fiction. If you're trying to convince someone to read it, the look on their face when you give it the book to them sometimes is just ridiculous. Actually, I tend to use Dan's, the Gaunt's Ghost ones to get people reading it.
Cool.
So the first thing
of course.
I was going to say, us, it's always Eisenhorn.
Well, because I know enough military guys where it's like, well, no, this is very much like Band of Brothers, but it's in space. It's a different premise. It's a different theme. You know, so it's something a little bit more interesting than, you know, reading war stories kind of over and over again, and that's going to keep you involved, but you're going to appreciate the base of it. Sorry, go ahead, Gemma.
No, it's fine. So, I mean, to get it to go mainstream, the first thing is, and it is starting to happen, but you'd have to get over the whole franchise it's a geek thing stereotype. And to do that would mean watering down the very thing that makes geeks like Warhammer.
You know, To that point, though, Game of Thrones has been a very, very successful show for HBO as sort of a serial show. And as someone who hadn't read the books before I watched the show, and I'm now going through reading the books, the first season of that show was exceptionally true to the book. You know, they kept plot point for plot point. Do you not feel that a franchise like Gaunt's Ghosts could be a successful, if not big, sort of Tinseltown Hollywood blockbuster? Could it not make an excellent money-making franchise for a TV series that's willing to do it?
I think, yes, if they were going to do anything with it, I'd much rather see
TV show,
you know, where you've got time, because Game of Thrones is a great example, Walking Dead's another great example, where they've taken something and they've been true to it by giving it enough room to tell the story, because it's not just the atmosphere and the universe that you want to evoke, it's the room to do justice to a story.
Yeah.
And I think that would be much, much more satisfying, right? Because people will come along and go, well, it's very interesting, but there are a lot of skulls. and then that will be it. But if you've got a 12 part miniseries and you're going, oh my God, I'm really into these characters, I can't believe that he killed Bragg, then you've got...
No, do it in the right voice, Dan.
Yeah. I can't believe they killed Bragg. you get a much more satisfying thing. The point is it's about the character and the storyline because it's about the narrative. Even in the game, it's about the narrative. That's why people love playing the game, and that's why people like reading the books. That's what it's about. The universe is fantastic because it gives us a wonderful scenery to play those narratives out against. But I think a movie would give you the set, but not necessarily enough of the narrative. A TV show would be much more successful.
Yeah, the problem with the movie as well is, I mean, not so much with the Gaunt's Ghost books, but an awful lot of Warhammer on 40K fiction, you have to already know at least a little bit about the franchise to understand what the hell is going on. I mean, that's why the George R. R. Martin's books are so thick, because he's world building, right? Mm. So if you look at the comparatively, most 40K books I pick up and read, they assume you know what Space Marines are. They assume you know who the Eldar are. And if you're trying to turn that to a mainstream audience for something like TV or a film, you can't make any of those assumptions. And you've got to bring all that in. And that's the bit that I think you'd run the risk of turning off a lot of the fans.
And it's quite a difficult image to sell, and I mean this in a very positive. Yeah. All the things we like about 40K are quite difficult for a more moderate mainstream audience to say
the same thing, yeah. Because
it's
for children especially, because when they talk about science fiction in any aspect, I mean, look at the last 20 science fiction movies to come out in the last few years here. You can maybe say three of them are exclusively adult, and the rest are selling toys along with selling the movie. And I think that that watered down version. Remove so much of what we would see in these stories coming to the mainstream audience.
Yeah, but don't you want to see a level of mainstream success where you can walk into the Old Navy and buy your camo cloaks and like fake las guns for Halloween?
Yeah. Now that would be fantastic. But the exemplar I would give you back is to what you want to avoid. And actually, don't just groan because it is an obvious one. But the original Judge Dredd movie, the Stallone Judge Dredd movie. Judge Dredd is a fantastic comic strip series. It's got some brilliant, brilliant, brilliant storylines in it. It's amazing. They made a big budget movie with a star, Stallone, who was completely committed to making that movie properly. But what they did was they cherry-picked bits of all the stories and put them together, so nothing made sense.
I had a really bad joke that I was going to throw out about Pontius Glaw saying, "I am the Glaw," but like since you brought up Judge Dredd, I can't not make that joke.
But as a movie, it didn't satisfy a mainstream audience, and it didn't satisfy the fans either. I think the new one's probably going to. But the point I'm making is that the danger is that a Warhammer movie will be a bit like that. And the other thing is that you've got to, the first thing they said in the Stallone film was that he's got to take his helmet off because you can see it's Stallone.
Oh, that was.
And it's like, well, the Dredd never takes his helmet off. So similarly, what we're going to say is we're going to say Space Marines. Where are the scenes where where we see them with their wives and girlfriends? Where are the scenes where they are not dressed in armor all the time?
Right.
And you can see that kind of very understandable sort of Hollywood wish list of how do we make this film accessible to all ages? Sort of people just sit there going down the list, going, well, everyone wears armor. Why is the galaxy on fire? Why that woman there? She's the only woman that we've seen in the last 4.5 hours. Like, why are her eyes sewn up? And then they'll say things like, could you do that scene again but with less skulls? But, it's part of the iconography of the game, which actually makes people a bit scared of it, I think. And that will make it a very, very difficult to sell. Because what would you rather have? Do you honestly want to see a Warhammer 40,000 film that is sort of declawed from its essential 40K-ness? I mean, that would be just horrible, Contractions. Space Marines don't talk in contractions. That's absolutely. If I let a Space Marine talk in a contraction, I get Alan Merrick gets on a train, comes to my house, and smacks me with a fish. I don't know why I use the fish. Don't. Let's not get complicated about it. But the point is, I'm not allowed to do it. So one of the big obstacles we had in the Ultramarines movie is they had to talk without using any contractions at any point. And it makes it quite stilted. Now, if you understand that that's what Space Marines are like, it doesn't matter. If you don't, you're going, why the hell are they talking like that all the time?
Lieutenant Commander Data. Why are they all Data?
I'm a technical writer that's not allowed to write in contractions. Yeah. So I understand the whole stilted language of that. So
wonderful. Okay, so we're kind of rolling on to the end of the hour here. If we go over, whatever, it's good time. So we had a couple of rapid-fire questions we wanted to throw at you, Dan.
Don't undersell it.
Yeah, well, a few.
Okay, go for it.
And these are loaded questions. Be wary. The first one probably
a rapier wit.
Sorry, what?
I have a rapier wit, so we're even.
All right. All right. I agree.
Okay, so the first one, probably the most loaded, Eisenhorn, hero or heretic?
Oh, just a complete bastard with a gun, basically.
So both.
That question will be okay. Quick answer: that question is going to be answered in the forthcoming Beckwin trilogy, which the first part of which Pariah comes out this autumn, as we spoke about it.
Yes, just fist bumped. You can't see it because it's a podcast.
Third of the three trilogies, so it's a trilogy of trilogies, and this is Eisenhorn versus Ravenna. So make of that what you will in terms of his hereticalness.
See, I love that you called it the Beckwin trilogy, because I've been sitting here for years saying that's not the end of her. We know this is not the end of her.
There you go.
There's silence. I'll take silence as an answer.
Silence is yes.
McVen are gone or coming back?
I never write anybody out of a Gaunt's Ghost, or indeed any series, but Gaunt's Ghost, nobody ever drops out without the idea that they will come back at some point.
I was going to say, take that with Bryn Milo as well.
With Bryn Milo as well.
That's my Milo, the Saint, and clearly that's applied to people like Sorek in the past. So, there's your answer.
I was going to say, Sorek was always my favorite, so you cut me twice with that.
Real quick, and I'm gonna cut out this because I had another question I wanted to throw in there, and this was a from the heart question. So in Xenos, in the Eisenhorn series, you introduced House Lang. My name is also Lang. Now the only character from House Lang was a coward who pissed himself before he died.
So
why do you have to come at me like that, Dan? That's what I want to know. Are we gonna get like a badass House Lang character in one of these stories?
I will do my best to rectify that. Clearly, the information I've been supplied back in 1999 was completely erroneous about you and your behavior under pressure.
Well, the hilarious thing about it was I was working for Games Workshop at the time, and my name is Lang, but it's spelled with an E at the end. And nobody spells Lang with an E at the end. And then that book spelt Lang with an E at the end. I was just like, that son of a bitch.
Yeah, but I was
And then he shits himself and dies.
At the same time, we worked for a guy whose last name was McKellar. So every time McKellar was in a Gaunt's Ghost book, he was just like, yes, I'm doing good.
And I know, you've talked to Mark, Dan.
Yes. There you go. Well, you know that I collect names, don't you?
Yes,
you do
yes.
know that. My little black book goes with me everywhere, and at any games day, I will collect the names of willing volunteers who are happy to have their surnames, or indeed Christian names, first of all, 40K-ized where necessary, so that they read, you know, in a grimdark way, and then B, get killed off in a Gaunt's Ghost book.
Because if only, that would be a dream. So it's Grenovich for me, and it's Holland for Nathan.
I would love to get killed off.
And Noon for Gemma, because I'm sure she would love that as well, but then she would complain about Bragg again.
I have to say, Noon is such a cool name that Noon's going to be a hero rather than just a.
Yes!
Yay!
I think it's an awesome name.
Can I kill Lang and Pullen?
Oh! That's a subplot! Oh my god, wait till the fanfic comes out. I'm going to write that when this shit's done. What does the inside of Ravenor's chair smell like?
Oh my goodness. Those little pine Christmas trees. Yeah, it's like that. He's got a couple of those in there.
Buys them in bulk from the 40K Costco.
They feed them in through the ventilator grills. he hands them up. He hangs them up with telekinesis, and
Oh my god! Okay, so as you can tell, we appreciate the drink here on Jada Gamercast. What does Amasek and Sakura taste most like?
Okay, Amasek is essentially brandy.
That's what's in our coffee right now.
And Sakura is essentially what's the name of the absolutely lethal stuff that the Irish homebrew Sheen?
Moonshine.
Yeah, like that. Yeah. I think they call it Pachin, but it is that. But it's got a kind of whiskeyish tint to it. But it's depends on who's brewed it, really.
Let's continue drinking.
I chose right because we'll keep drinking the Amasek. We are actually through most of a bottle at this point.
It is 11 a.m. here.
It is 11 a.m.
You can now see through time.
Guys. Yes. I can send faxes to the past. What's your favorite curse word, Gak or Feth?
It's got to be Feth, hasn't it?
That was our call.
We used Feth earlier in the podcast, so we assumed we had the answer for that. But
any other made-up curse words that you're going to be adding to current books? Because we haven't really gotten one from the
Belladon
yet.
Oh, we haven't yet. I actually say my favorite, but Feth is an all-time favorite. I write a comic strip for 2000 AD in the UK called Sinister Dexter about two hitmen, and they also have their own invented language, and their favorite swear words are scuzzpuck. Somebody's a scuzzpuck, but they also say funt, which I love, actually, as a swear word goes. It looked really, really good written down.
Yeah. Well, here, I'll throw one at you right now. You can tell me what you think. Cunk bag. Because cunk bag is the non-swear word that sounds the dirtiest. Cunk bag. Okay.
It's pretty
What's
good.
A cunk bag?
It's pretty...
Nothing. Nothing sounds disgusting.
Yeah.
What do you think about cunk bag, Gemma?
I'm impressed.
There you are.
Well, how could you not?
We aim to please here at Jaded Gamercast, the most J-list of podcasts on the internet.
It is true.
Which character for you was the hardest to kill?
Spoiler alert. Then it would probably be the characters who may or may not have died at the end of Salvation's Reach.
Ooh. Oh shit! May or may not,
because people might not be quite that far into the series yet. So I, you know, but there are some fairly traumatic things that happen at the end of that.
He's mostly dead.
He's feeling a bit better. He might go for a walk.
All right, so Rocket Raccoon, when they make the movie, is he going to be the next Jar Jar Binks? Is that a fear for you?
Always. When any, yes, the next Jar Jar Binks of anything will be a fear.
God forbid it be one of your characters.
Well, Rocket Raccoon was hilarious because when you saw that was a choice for the team in the first issue, you sat there going like, what the fuck is Dan thinking? Because it was so ridiculous. Like those, like the Howard the Duck characters. And I mean, props to Frank Van Lant right now, who's doing Howard the Duck a lot of service. But, you know, like Rocket Raccoon, you sat there and said, this is what's happening. And then he is one of the most charming characters in the book. So you do worry. I mean, we talked about this for the mainstream. You worry about what they're going to do with these characters. And especially considering the fact that his personality was nothing until you wrote him.
Yeah. It is. It's the same. I think the thing is that the trick is here, writing secret trick time here, guys. If you want anybody to believe in a character and invest in a character, you've got to take that character seriously, even if it's a talking tree or a gun-toting raccoon or a telepathic Russian cosmonaut dog or whatever it is. You take that character completely seriously, even if they are intrinsically
I'll give you
funny.
The Guardians of the Galaxy
okay,
comic.
Good,
Nathan's waving like, me toward those comics
yeah,
right
he's
now.
Just like, you know, you're describing all these characters. I'm just like, shit, I need your copies.
Yeah, I've got them all in a box. You can have them. Sorry, go ahead, Dan.
Well, no, that, and that's it. I think if Andy and I had looked at Rocket Raccoon and gone, really, it's a talking raccoon with a gun? I don't know. But we just went, okay, it's a talking raccoon with a gun. What would that be like? And that's
well, he's soulful at times, which you just never expect.
Yeah. I think it's that. It is that, one of the my favorite moments with it, because as you pointed out, Groot, who is the walking tree, only ever says, "I am Groot."
Yes.
And there is a moment, I think it's in War of Kings, where he's talking to Maximus the Mad of the Inhumans. Yes. We realize that in fact it's only humans can hear. That's what the humans hear him say. But in fact, he is either having really, really complicated conversations where he's talking about particle physics, and it sounds like he's saying, "I am Groot," or Maximus the Mad is mad.
Well, I love the idea that all of a sudden, with that character, it wasn't that he's saying more than I am Groot. It was that he says what Maximus the Mad actually says, like, oh, and he's very well spoken, and you're all rude for not replying to the thing. He says he keeps asking you questions, you know, and again, that might just be my own brain, the fan fiction I write. But really,
it's likely erotic.
Likely erotic. Let's not lie, Rocket Raccoon and Groot. he's a floral colossus. You take that however you want to take it.
Absolutely.
I was gonna say usually.
I have a feeling we should move on from this topic.
I was just gonna say usually by the end we're a little more drunk than we were.
Well, we
beginning.
We drank a lot this show. We're not done yet. Okay, if I beg and plead, Dan, can I get you to ask somebody at Marvel to let you write Alpha Flight?
Okay. I love Alpha Flight, by the way. John Byrne on Alpha Flight, fantastic.
Thank
I
you.
Love that run. Yeah. No, it's very appealing. Yeah. Box.
Mm.
And
I have to hear about Alpha Flight every time I come up to visit. So
we're Canadian. You're the only Canadian who doesn't like Alpha Flight.
I just don't like Marvel. It's not big personal.
That's your own damn fault.
Yeah, it's fair.
I don't hold it against you, but don't hold it against me, because Alpha Flight's amazing. And I mean, again, Frank Millent, he did an amazing job in the last run there. It was going to become an ongoing, and then it stopped becoming ongoing, and it seems like there's this hate in Marvel toward Alpha Flight. And again, we're Canadians, or at least I am. Nathan's some pseudo-Canadian who doesn't like Alpha Flight. But really, like, what is it about that team that makes it that we just can't get an ongoing series since the 80s? You're the inside track here, Dan.
I really don't know the answer to that question, to be honest. I was also holding out high hopes for the Great Lakes Avengers. They were the other ones that I really wanted to see.
Yes.
I really want to see a comic in which Vindicator appears with Captain Britain and Captain America. I just think that's really cool. You know, the three flag costumes. How brilliant would that be? Or Union Jack, if Captain Britain's not available. I don't know.
Union Jack is always the backup, unfortunately.
Yeah. So he is so pissed off about that. He has his entire career plan marked out from World War II onwards, and then suddenly in the 1980s, Captain Britain turns up and pretends he's been around since King Arthur's days. I mean, how pissed off do you think he feels?
You've already written a comic for this character, haven't you? You're just waiting for Marvel to hand that over.
Let's get a win for the green light.
All right. Well, I was hoping that you would say, yes, we're going to get you Alpha Flight. But, you know, that's the way that it goes. So what can we expect from you in the future here, Dan? Obviously, you're working a lot with comics. Like I said, we both read Hypernaturals here. I'm quite enjoying the first few issues.
Mm-hmm.
I'm totally expecting these characters to die exceptionally gruesome deaths, considering track record. Considering your track record for original characters,
well, considering the whole team died before, in like the first page intro where you're reading about it, you're just like, wait, what?
First page spoilers,
right? Have you opened the cover? Yes, you know this.
So, what do you have planned for Hypernaturals? Like, is this something that you feel like you're really connected to creatively that you're going to be taking very far?
When you world build that to that level and you create a universe, I think you feel very, very creative with it. And it is a very, very big storyline that we're telling here. So yes, comic-wise, that and for my purposes, the New Dead Audience over at Vertigo, the two big things occupying us at the moment. There are other things coming along. In terms of novels, I've got, obviously, Pariah is out very soon. After that, I'm moving on to something for the Black Library that I'm not allowed to talk about at the moment. And also the next Horus Heresy book, which is called The Unremembered Empire and is a direct sequel to Know No Fear.
Ooh,
that will be getting written at the end of this year. And then after that will be Gaunt 14, which is called War Master.
Ooh, Makarov.
Ah, see what I did there.
Yes.
And I'm also writing Andy Lanning and I have got a series for Penguin Puffin Books in the UK, which is a YA adventure series that's the first volume of which comes out next year. And I'm also writing another of my original novels for Angry Robot
I've
published two of mine, Triumph and Embedded, which are both
awesome.
Thank you very much indeed.
Oh, have you read them, Gemma?
I'm now writing a third.
Of course I did.
There will be a sequel to Triumph and a sequel to Embedded at some point.
Oh, awesome.
Stories set in those universes, certainly. But I'm now writing a book, which I'm going to mention it anyway, because if I'm not allowed to, who's going to stop me at this point?
Yeah, we're not going to edit that shit out. Cock tits. Just
fiction,
go.
The huge science fiction action thing called Monster Side, which will be out next year and is absolutely enormous. And it's about the planet under attack from monsters and what people have to do in order to commit monstercide with a C. And that is to say, how do you kill monsters? So it's a huge, 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 huge cosmic monsters, Earth in peril story, which I'm having great fun with.
Now, you've said a lot of times that you tend to dig into the history of various eras, like where they align. Obviously, with Gaunt's Ghost, it aligns this way. With Space Wolves, it aligns toward Vikings. For that monster side thing, is it aligning toward more like a 50s B-real type movie feature?
There's a lot of that. Well, I'm actually looking at almost every sort of aspect of great monster mythology. So, yes, there's definitely 50s stuff going on. There's definitely very, very sort of, Not specifically, but very sort of Lovecraftian feelings of Cthulhu mythos and, you know, sort of things that should not be properly visualized. But there's also an awful lot of sort of St. George and the Dragon and ancient warriors fighting, you know, sort of Arthurian themes of eternal warriors who have to fight monsters when they arise, and the monsters have stalked mankind forever. So the story of Beowulf and Grendel, the story of
That's interesting. It'll piss off Union Jack, but it's interesting.
Well, it's because he'll just be waiting next to the phone, just waiting for a call.
Just waiting for
coming.
A call. When's that feature film coming for Union Jack? Oh my God! All right, well. Dan, Gemma, it has been an absolute pleasure. I think we've run a little bit long, but I think, we probably hit about an hour there. I can't wait to meet you at the expo, Dan. Gemma, as well, I can't wait to meet you there. You guys have been a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm just impressed I haven't squealed like a schoolgirl.
See, I've squealed three times.
Especially when Dan was just like, oh yeah, there's going to be a couple more God's Ghost series. I was just like,
well, we did a lot of fist bumping quietly. Like, you can't see that on the podcast, but it's exceptionally bad for people like our age to be acting that.
Yeah, I was going to say, we both have kids. We both have kids, we have careers. The way that it works. Still squealing like we're at a Justin Bieber concert.
That's absolutely true. But you know what? Like I said, I buy any comic with your name on it. I buy any book with your name on it. Absolutely love your work, Dan. And you know what? Keep that work up because you've got two sales right here. Can't wait to see you at the expo. Gemma, quickly, what's all the expo information again?
Tickets are $20. It's on 6th and 7th of October this year, and you can buy the tickets at www.chestmereexpo.ca.
Awesome. So that's been Jaded Gamercast for this week. My name is Lang.
I'm Nathan.
Gemma and hello. Dan Abnett. Goodbye. Have a good one. Cheers.
Cheers.
Hey.
Sorry, I'm just like...